This is 4:55 on Monday, September 26th. Good morning.
So, exam week on Friday. In this room, of course.
On Wednesday, we will do some review for the exam. I will go over sort of some of the stuff. Other things for study, of course, are the CLICS questions, your homeworks. It would be probably very helpful to have started on the project, not done with the project. That's definitely not needed, but just it would give you some sense of the system calls from a really practical way instead of just memorizing things. Let's see. The assignment for Chapter 3 is due on Wednesday at midnight. I will post the answers on Thursday, therefore no late submissions on the assignment that's due Wednesday, because you won't get any credit for them if they're late. Please sign into CLICS for attendance. There are no questions today, just so I know you're here. Let's see. Anything else? I don't know of any other announcement sort of things. Any questions logistically?
So I was working on homework 3.
Uh-huh.
Is that okay? Did I ask a question on that?
Yeah.
Okay. I must have missed it somewhere, but is the window size, is that basically just a...
We're about to talk about
cool.
that.
All right.
Okay. We're about to talk about that.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Just the very next slide. So let's get going on that then. All right. So, window size. very, very next thing. So think about the problem of reliable data delivery and keeping the link full. Remember, keeping the link full, getting good link utilization was what we talked about at the end last time. Let me switch to display mode here. We talked about last time that with time going down the scale here and distance going across, packets sort of travel in time and distance simultaneously arriving at the receiver. And the fraction of the timeline that is occupied is the utilization of the link. How much of the time are you actually sending on the link? And our goal was to get the utilization up much larger than this very tiny amount that we had before. So in order to do that, the sender had to be willing to have multiple outstanding packets or multiple outstanding bytes that had not yet been acknowledged, right? Because the first one that you send, the acknowledgement is going to come back quite a while later. We've got to be able to send data. Okay, so how much data is the sender willing to have outstanding that's unacknowledged is called the window size. That's one aspect of the window size anyway. And that we're going to see is influenced by two things. It's influenced by the flow control algorithm, which is how is the receiver willing to have that has not yet been delivered to the application, right? How much data is the receiver TCP implementation willing to hold on to and not yet deliver to the application, because that's taking up buffer space on the receiver, and so that's an issue. And the other thing that governs the window size is the congestion control, which is the network's influence over how much data the sender is willing to send at a given time. Okay? So that's sort of the background of all this. So here's sort of how it goes. The sender has this window size, and we're going to talk later about where the actual number for the window size comes from, but for now, just assume it has this window size, and within that window, it will have already sent some of the data, generally speaking, and there will be some more spaces, generally speaking, that it has not yet sent. So it's willing to use the blue slots if the application should give it some data to send, but it's not willing to go beyond that point, and so these are not possible. And the green ones back here represent data that's already been acknowledged, right? So that's the picture, and that color coding is going to continue through the discussions of windows. Green for already acknowledged, yellow for sent but not yet acknowledged, blue for usable, and white for not usable. I'll save that. So our first approach to doing this is the so-called go back and sender, which when it detects a need to retransmit, which will happen because of, say, a timeout, it sent something and it has not received an acknowledgement within a reasonable amount of time, that means, well, the acknowledgement it needs to get is this one. So it has not received an acknowledgement, it just goes back to that point and resends everything from that point on. That's the so-called go back in protocol. The other one is selective acknowledgments, in which some of these intermediate ones may have been acknowledged. There's some earliest one that's unacknowledged, and in which case you would only retransmit the ones for which you're missing acknowledgments. Okay, so that's go back in or selective acknowledgment. And I don't want to go over that, but let's just see what happens. So now here's the I think the issue in the homework assignment is that we can have a window size, right? How much data are we willing to have unacknowledged? But we also have, and interacting with that is the available sequence number space. So it's really convenient if sequence numbers can just start at zero and go to infinity. But sequence numbers have to fit in finite numbers of bits. And so for any given protocol, there's going to be a minimum sequence number and a maximum sequence number. And when you reach the maximum, you have to wrap around to the minimum. Okay? That's going to be important here in a second. But we won't get to that wraparound issue quite yet. So the window is this blue spot. And this blue highlighted stuff, and when we send packets, the window doesn't move. Right? The blue thing doesn't move as we send these packets. When acknowledgments come back, the window moves. And when a packet is lost, what does that mean? It means that there's no acknowledgement coming back for that packet. The window doesn't move. The window can only move when we get the acknowledgement for the packet that's at the beginning of it. The sequence number that's at the beginning of it. Okay? So, receive packet 3. Go back in says that the acknowledgement number that's in packet 3 represents the last thing that was in order, number 1. We haven't got number 2. We got number 3, but 3 is now out of order, right? Because we don't have 2 at the receiver. So we re-acknowledge the last one we got that was in order. The sender gets that, says, oh, that's a duplicate, right? It's looking at Act 1, and Act 1 is sort of
already acknowledged it's a duplicate. We don't worry about it.
So then we receive packet 2. Let's see what happens. When we receive packet 2, go back in and resend all of these packets.
That's not.
What?
That's not right. When we send packet 2.
When we resend packet 2.
Oh, sorry.
When we resend packet 2 after the timeout, because it's go back in, we resend everything after packet 2 as well and get back acknowledgments for all of them. Now, it's very likely, actually, that when this gets delivered, the thing that we're going to get is an acknowledgement for 5, right? Because 5 has been received, in which case this whole thing. Okay. Questions about that? Okay, so selective repeat or selective acknowledgement, individual acknowledgements, sender only resends packets for which ACK is not received. But the same issue applies about we've got a sequence number space and we've got a window size within it, and I'm going to show you something here in a second that will make that clearer. Okay, yeah.
I had a question about the timeout. Does that affect utilization?
You bet.
Okay.
Having reached the limit of the window, the sender is now silent.
Right.
Until the timeout occurs.
Right.
Okay. So utilization goes down. So what do we want? We want the timeout to be sort of close to the actual round trip time,
okay.
Right? So that the timeout would occur, about the time that we would get packet 2. On the other hand, if the timeout occurs before the arrival of packet 2's acknowledgement, then what happens? Then we waste time by resending all the data that was missing. So we'll talk about timeout choice here in a moment. Okay, so here's the picture for selective acknowledgments. We have out of order things now. This is the receive buffer, the receiver's window size, different color scheme. We're expecting always the first thing in the window. That's what we're always expecting. We did add it, and so we've acknowledged the latest. Clear. Simple enough. That's good. I think there's anything there. So let's see how selective repeat works. Same deal. Nothing really much changes except that the window doesn't advance past 2 until the ACK for 2 arrives. And then what happens? Well, we have, if you study this picture, go look at it later. If you study this picture, you'll see that we've already received ACKs for 3 and 4. Wait a second. This is 5. It says send ACK 5 and receive ACK 4. That's a mistake on the slide. You might want to make a note of that for when you're looking later at these. 5 has been received. So what happens at this point to the receiver window? To the sender window. Where's it going to move to? I think I heard it whispered. Be bold. Sin boldly. It moves to 6, right? Because 5's been acknowledged, that makes it to a past history. We're now ready for 6. Even though we haven't sent 6, the sender window can still include 6. Or still start with 6. Okay. So now here's where we get into the discussion about the sequence number space and the window size. And
roughly the same thing occurs with go back in as occurs with selective repeat. I think the homework question actually that you're referring to probably discusses this.
So here we go. We have a window size of 3, right? It's blue. The receiver, we haven't talked about the receiver's window very much yet, but the receiver also has a window size of 3. And so we send, we're able to send 0, 1, and 2. The sender window doesn't move. We get back the first acknowledgement, it moves. We get back the second acknowledgement, it moves. And now we have packet that's been lost. Okay? So, that's all good. Packet 3 gets retransmitted, and sometime later, so packet 3 gets retransmitted, this window moves, sometimes later its ACK comes back, and this window moves, and all is good.
Here's the problem.
Let's consider a different scenario. Blah, 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 same thing. All of the acknowledgments get lost. Here, it was the packet that got lost. Here, it's the acknowledgments that get lost. The receiver moves its window when it has successfully received a packet. And so it's received all three, and it's moved its window. Okay. The sender only moves its window when it receives acknowledgments. Okay? So when the timeout occurs here, it resends this 0. Okay? The receiver is expecting the second generation packet with 0. Okay? And it will happily accept the one that we just sent as being the second generation 0. Alright? So, to avoid this, we have to make the sequence number space big enough that this can't happen. So that we don't wrap around and be willing to accept 0 when he's still willing to send the previous generations. All right? And that's what the question is about. Does that deal with the issue? Good. And the part of the thing here is that, remember, the sender and receiver can't see each other's states except by the contents of the messages that go back and forth between them. Right? That's sort of what's at the root of things here. You're sort of tempted as an omniscient outside observer to say, oh, that shouldn't happen. But in fact, he can't know what he's doing except on the basis of what's in the protocol and the messages.
Questions about that? Yes.
So I guess I missed this, but what happens if it's not in the same order as the window?
So with selective heat, the arrival of messages gets recorded, and they get acknowledged, but the window doesn't move until the first message is received. And similarly here, the window doesn't move until the first acknowledgement.
Okay, so those were the sort of principles of reliable data transfer. Let's look at how they play out in TCP. Just to review, point to point, one sender, one receiver, reliable in order byte stream. Typo is still on that slide. We often have byte streams. Byte streams are better. There are no message boundaries. The sends and receives don't line up. We talked about all of that. It's pipelined. That was a word that we came up with last time. Remember to talk about having multiple messages outstanding, just like we've been talking about. TCP implements simultaneously streams going in both directions over one connection. And that's, I mean, that's heavy, but it's sort of not fundamental to the way it works. So we'll generally talk about data flowing in one direction. So that's called full duplex. That means that you can be sending in both directions at once. There's something called a maximum segment size. Okay. Connection-oriented. Remember we talked about in order to achieve reliable data transfer, you have to go above and beyond the facilities of the basic internet. That's network delivery. And to achieve that, TCP requires that that the client contact the server and say, I want to talk, and we go through a little dance before we start sending data. That's the connection oriented here, and it's flow controlled, so the sender will not overwhelm the receiver. And does it say on the next slide? No, it doesn't. It's flow controlled and it's congestion controlled, so that the sender attempts not to overwhelm the network either. Okay, so TCP segments, where's the network header in relation to this? Above it, right? Yes. Don't ever forget that, right? The network header is above the transport header in these pictures. It's not shown, but it's definitely there. Like with UDP, there's a source port number and a destination port number. How many bits in each of them? 16, right? Half of the 32 is shown by the diagram. There's a sequence number in the packet. How many bits? 32, right? Which allows for roughly 4 billion different sequence numbers. There's an acknowledgement number of the same size. We're going to see how those two things relate to each other in a second. And these numbers count bytes, not segments. Okay? Why? Because segment boundaries don't have any meaning in TCP. Right? Things can get resegmented at various stages, and so different people would have different counts of the number of segments, but everybody agrees on the number of bytes. Okay. There are a bunch of bit flags here. We generally don't use urgent data and push. You know, you may see push if you look at packets. They have to do with sort of the timing. Push has to do with the timing of acknowledgments and sending. And in some highly interactive protocols, it may be useful. Yes?
How does the receiver know the sender's IP? Is that like the network layer diagram?
Yes. Yes, that's where it is. Up here in the network header, what do we have? Source IP, destination IP, header checksum.
And so are sockets considered network layer?
Sockets are not protocols. Sockets are OS APIs. Okay? So sockets get bound to chunks of network protocol stuff, but they are not protocols. Okay. So anyway, we're going to talk then about the R, S, and F flags and the A flag. But U and P are not used. The header length is, how many bits do you think the header length is?
4, 1,
1,
5,
16,
16.
Well, 2, no,
5.
Yeah. No, wait.
I think it's not to scale. I don't even remember. It's a pretty small number of bits, though, right? Because if this is 32, this is 16.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
That leaves 10. Well, maybe 5. I don't know. But it's a pretty small number. In fact, it's expressed as the number of 8-bit chunks in the header. Okay. It's just scaled.
Okay, the receive window, guess what, is from the perspective of the sender, if the receive window is sensed by the receiving end of a connection and tells the sender for that connection how many bytes the receiver is willing to have. And so the sender will limit its send window to at most that many. And that will, in fact, ensure that whenever the sender sends something, the receiver has a place to put it. It's a little tricky to think about, but it is true. There is a checksum over the contents of the header and the data that just helps protect against certain kinds of errors. Urgent data, like I said, is related to the uFlag used. Options are some things that can be added to the header as during connection setup, but also later, to do things like say, all right, the receive window is a 16-bit number. What does that limit the size of the receive window to in terms of number of bytes? 2 to the 16th, which is about 64K bytes, right? On really fat, that is high transmit bandwidth, long pipes, it's very easy to exceed 64K as the amount you need to keep it full. Right, the bandwidth delay product may be much larger than 64K. So one of the options, for example, is to say, I'm going to send you receive windows that are scaled by some power of 2. So maybe I scale it by 2 to the 10th, and then my receive windows are expressed in kilobytes instead of bytes. Okay, and that's a way to get bigger windows. Okay. Other questions about this? And we'll talk about the meaning of the flags here in a second. So it's a lot more complicated than UDP. UDP just had the source and destination ports and the sum and the length. No, the length.
I think it had the length. Okay. So here we go. Here's our green, yellow, and blue, gray picture for sequence number space. Green things sent an act. Yellow things sent and not yet act. Blue things that we could send but haven't yet sent. And gray things that are outside the window. So when we send data back to here.
Data right here. We send a chunk of data on the stream. The sequence number is the position of the first byte of that data in the stream.
So the very first byte in the stream is position 0. Right? Well, except quite, because part of the TCP connection establishment protocol uses up one sequence number. So the very first byte is in fact 1. And I still lied. Because the other thing that happens is every TCP connection starts with a random sequence number as its initial sequence number. Okay? So everything is relative to that random initial sequence number, but we can think of it as being relative to zero and not go too far wrong. Okay. So, is TCP go back in, or is it selective repeat? Um,
It could be sort of either.
What matters, what TCP says, is
that the acknowledgement number is the position of the on the sender's side of the next byte that I'm waiting for. So we're going to look at some examples.
Let's go on to the
problem. All right. So we're somewhere in the middle of a TCP stream. Let's just do this. Sequence number of the data in this segment is 42, and the data is a single character, C. One byte. All right? So the receiver constructs an acknowledgement that says, I'm now waiting for byte number 43. I just got number 42. I'm now waiting for 43. So that's what the acknowledgement does. And notice how the data flow through here, through the sequence number. The acknowledgement number coming this direction depends on is related to the sequence number coming this direction, and vice versa. Okay, so this is a little telnet application. It echoes back what it gets. So he said that I'm waiting for data number 79, and assuming all is well, then this will be number 79, and so that would be fine. And when we send back an acknowledgement with no data, it's perfectly fine to send no data in the forward direction, just to send an acknowledgement. So we acknowledge 80. All right. So this is something that people always get tripped up over: is that the sequence number is the position of the first byte of data that's in the segment, and the acknowledgement number is the first byte that I'm waiting for. It's not the last byte I received. It's the first byte that I'm waiting for.
Guess what? Exam question.
Somebody didn't like that comment
at all, did they? Okay, so that's how sequence numbers and acknowledgement numbers work. The A bit, remember there's that A bit in the header, says that the acknowledgement number is valid in the packet, and that will be set to 1 for all packets except the very first one that sets up the TCP connection. Because the acknowledgement number is always valid except then. All right. We still have to talk about the R and S bits. That will come later. Before we do that, let's go back to here.
Okay, what if the acknowledgement number, if the acknowledgement doesn't arrive for this first packet that I've sent in the window? Then we have to have a timeout, right? We said that. And TCP's timeout has to deal with the internet as the thing that it's measuring. So we said we wanted to have a timeout that would occur sort of close to when the acknowledgement was expected. We wouldn't want it too early. That would cause us to do extra work. We wouldn't want it too late because that would make us slow down. So the question is, what exact time should that be? Right? How do we figure that out? And the way it works in TCP is that we measure the round trip times, right? We send a packet, it's got a sequence number in it. Sometime later we get back a packet that acknowledges that segment, and that's how long the round trip time was. Right? So for every segment we send, at least the first time, sometime later we get back a acknowledgement, and that gives us a sample of the round trip. Okay, and so we measure those round trip times for those packets, and we would typically see something that would look like this. And what you notice is that they're not very constant, right? This is the internet, right? The packet is going over multiple hops, it's suffering congestion sometimes, who knows, right? It's very, very variable, very variable. And so what should we set the timeout to? It's still not obvious even when we make all these measurements. So here's what the clever folks who designed this came up with. They created a scheme that uses what's called the exponential moving average, and I think there's probably a question about this amongst the homework as well. The exponential moving average to sort of, as things change, slowly change the estimate of the average round trip time. Okay? And the way it works is that every time we get a acknowledgement back, we take previous estimate and weight it by an amount 1 minus alpha, and our current estimate weighted by alpha, and we get a new estimated round trip time. So why is it called the exponential moving average? Well, if you write these with a subscript and say this is estimated round trip time 1 is equal to something of estimated round trip time 0, and then estimated round trip time 2 is equal to something of estimated round trip time 1, and so on. You write down a bunch of those. What you'll see is that the initial sample RTT 0, the weight of it goes to 0. So it just gradually moves out of the estimate as time goes by, and so more recent estimates have somewhat more influence, and older ones end up with almost no influence. Okay, and so typical estimate value for alpha. Alpha, of course, has to be between 0 and 1 for this to make sense. It's a very common scheme. You see it in all kinds of situations. Graduate students inventing it over again and thinking that it's going to get them their thesis. Not. It's not. It's very useful technique. Okay, so now we've got our estimated average round trip time. Is that a good number to use for the timeout?
I don't like the max value on that.
Well, no, we don't want the max value because we want to sort of forget ancient history and be more current than that, and that's what I think. But look at this. This is the estimated average. If it's the average, then they're going to be half above, roughly, and half below.
Right.
And we don't want to be timing out for the ones above, right? That would be a lot of timeouts, right? So what do? We do the second order version of this and say, let's estimate how wiggly this thing is. Okay? How big are the wiggles and how much does it wiggle? That's called the variation or deviation. And we essentially do the same thing again. We figure out how much the current sample deviates from the current estimate, and we factor that into the calculation as well to come up with the deviation of the round trip time, and it also uses a exponential weight moving average. And then we say our timeouts are the estimated average plus a safety margin, which is 4 times the deviation. Now, the 4 is the only thing here that's sort of arbitrary. Well, not quite. The things that are arbitrary.
gained from experience. Alpha, an eighth. Beta, a quarter. And four.
Right.
All of those sort of go into making up what exactly you're going to choose as the timeout, but these have proven to be sort of okay in practice.
So yeah, that's empirically, that's how they.
Empirically, that's how they do it. So, okay. So now we have a way to come up with the round trip time. I need to say one thing before I forget, because I didn't say it before. Suppose that a segment has been retransmitted and we get back the acknowledgement for that segment. Right? It's transmitted again, and then we get back the acknowledgement. Should I use that sample round trip time in this calculation? Well, that's a misleading question. What is the sample round trip time for something where I've transmitted it once and transmitted it again and then gotten back an acknowledgement? I don't know. So those get thrown out of this calculation. Those are not used in this calculation. If you've retransmitted something, when you get its acknowledgement, you don't incorporate that into this calculation because you don't know whether it was an acknowledgement for the first one you transmitted or the second one. Okay. Why does it say that? Oh, yes. Okay, so I think now we have all the machinery we need to see how TCP does reliable data transfer. Obviously, I send some data, I start a timer, and if I don't get an acknowledgement for that data by the time the timer goes off, then I retransmit the data. That's pretty obvious. That's what we've been building up to here. On the receiver side, when I get data, what do I acknowledge? Suppose I get a sequence number 47. What should my acknowledgement be?
48.
Maybe.
No.
Depends. As in so many things. The answer is, it depends. If I've already received everything else up to 47, then my acknowledgement is 48.
Okay.
Right? But if I haven't, my acknowledgement is the place I've already gotten up to. It's the beginning of the first gap. Right?
Okay.
Because that's the next thing that I need to make progress, is the beginning of my next gap. Okay? So, that's the basic idea. And you can study the state machine. And we can look at what happens. Two scenarios. The acknowledgement is lost. Sometime later, we resend the data. That's fine. A delayed acknowledgement, right? This one didn't come back soon enough, so a timeout happened, so we retransmitted that packet. Note that we've already received 120. So not only could there be a gap, it could be a receipt of a duplicate packet, and we acknowledge ahead of what we just got. This is a good one to practice. Practice looking at the sequence numbers and acknowledgement numbers. Sequence number 92, containing 8 bytes of data, results in an acknowledgement of 100. Exam questions, guys. Okay. Sequence number 100 containing 20 bytes of data, it results in an acknowledgement of 120. Should have it together. Okay.
What happens if this acknowledgement is lost, but both data packets get through? Well, from the receiver's perspective, the receiver is not visible to the sender. From the receiver's perspective, everything is good here. And so it says, I send acknowledgement 100, I'll send 120. The sender's happy with that, right? Because the 120 represents everything up through 119. Doesn't have to get this one in order to be happy. And then there's this other little tweak, and no exam question about this. This is just minor optimization. Arrival of an in-order segment with the expected sequence number. Okay, so basically everything is good. All data up to the expected sequence number has already been at. The TCP receiver will actually delay for up to half a second in sending that acknowledgement, on the theory that it will get another segment and it will be able to combine the acknowledgements. Just reduces the amount of acknowledgement traffic a little bit. If you get the second segment when you're in this state, you immediately send the ACK that represents both of those. Okay, suppose that something arrives out of order, that is, it has a higher than expected sequence number, then what we do is immediately send the same ACK that we sent previously, saying, no, I don't want that one, I want this one, the earlier one. Okay. And finally, if we get something that fills a gap in our space, then we may jump ahead the acknowledgement number. All right, so these duplicate acts, the ones that we send in response to the fact that we've got a hole in our received space, can also speed up the recovery from lost data. How? So the problem is that the timeout is long and made longer by the need to be sort of careful about it. But if the receiver gets three segments past the gap, there's a gap at the receiver. It has gotten data past the gap. It has resent, by the previous rule, the acknowledgement saying, no, I want that one in the gap. The sender interprets that as, oh, probably that segment was lost, and retransmits it immediately. And that's called fast retransmit. So it's a way to not have to wait for the timeout, but rather get an indication from the receiver that something's missing and act on that immediately. Okay. So that's fast retransmit. Okay, so a picture of that. If it had arrived here, we would be sending acknowledgments with 120. The later ones arrive and we just keep saying, no, I'm still waiting for that one guy. And so after getting three duplicates, in other words, four in total, it retransmits it before the timeout happens. Okay. And hopefully, if all goes well, then we're able to recover from that. The window size is far enough beyond this that we are able to just keep going and not lose anything.
Okay, and then flow control, time, out of time. So, next time, we will do flow control and we will do congestion control and we will do review for the exam. Any quick questions? We're really... Yeah.
So everything up to Wednesday is going to be on the exam?
Pardon?
Everything
up to Wednesday is going to be on the exam. Yep, because that'll take us all the way through chapter 3.
have a notion of
the Oh, yes. Yeah, so before you go, guys, for the exam, you will have permission to have a 1 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper with your notes on it. Okay. Front and back. One sheet. Handwritten, typewritten.
Sorry, sometimes I use this for algorithm.
One moment. 26. Yes.
Yeah, so for the exam, would there be a particular emphasis on chapter 3?
No. It covers the whole thing.
Okay. Evenly spread.
But yeah, roughly.
Okay, thank you.
So the server and the client each have a separate sequence number, correct?
Right.
Okay, I just wanted to make those a little...
Yeah, server and client sort of gets at this stage. Once it's established, the connection is established, server and client sort of disappears.
Okay.
And we'll talk about, from the sender's perspective and the receiver's perspective, of recognize that there are two senders and two receivers.
Okay. And for between UDP sockets and TCP sockets, the reason why to keep the extra two, like, it has the tuple, the quadruple tuple.
Uh-huh.
Reason it has that is just for confirming like who's actually sending the bytes, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, and directing things to multiple sockets, because remember, I've got a listening socket for TCP. I've got a listening socket that I call accept all, and when I return from that accept, I've got a new socket. Okay.
Okay.
And that new socket is associated with all four things: the two port numbers and the two IP addresses.
Okay.
Some other client, or even the same client, connects again to that socket, I'll get another socket. But it'll have a different
okay.
set of four values, so because the client can't have two, even the same IP address, the client can't have two sockets going at once.
Okay, so the one socket dishes out other sockets, basically.
Uh-huh.
Right, and you just have different processes running, basically. Where
you
each
can have different processes, different threads.
Okay.
Even in a single thread, it's possible to use what's called non-blocking I.O. or selective I.O. or polling I.O. to manage multiple sockets at once.
Okay, that makes sense.
Uh-huh.